You can listen to The Professional Left on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, where you can also contribute to this podcast. There is a PayPal button at our website, or you can mail us a letter and or contribution at P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791.
This is the podcast for September 20th, 2013. It's not safe for work.
Recorded live while waiting for the Pope's cold call, it's The Professional Left with Driftglass and Blue Gal. Yeah.
Yeah. When is the Pope going to call us again?
Yeah, well,
I keep waiting.
Last night, middle child was on the phone for about an hour with somebody.
Oh, yeah, that's right. He was probably, the phone was busy.
And she said there was all this tapping on the line.
Tweens.
And
we have two tweens and a teen. So, yeah well, that's going to happen.
But the call, according to the call record, it came from Cupertino, California. So maybe
on Google Phone.
Yeah, I'm thinking the Pope's using Google Phone. Just for goofs.
Well,
you know.
I want to hat tip Nicole Bell of Crooks and Liars.
Yeah, hey, Nicole.
Big time thanks for all the linky love she gave us last week.
Yeah.
On her Sunday bobblehead thread for the Sunday shows. She let everybody know how important it is to listen to us, which is awesome. Thank you. I think she linked your blog, too.
She did. Apparently, I'm still writing a blog, and she got it.
She got it. So, awesome, and thank you. But she also sent some people an email about the Pope. And he's done a big interview with a Jesuit magazine. And he says... he's setting a new tone for the church, saying it should be a home for all and not a small chapel focused on doctrine, orthodoxy, and a limited agenda of moral teachings. It is not necessary to talk about these issues all the time. The dogmatic and moral teachings of the church are not all equivalent. The church's pastoral ministry cannot be obsessed with the transmission of a disjointed multitude of doctrines to be imposed insistently. Boy.
Wow.
It sounds like he's almost... listening. And can we just up front do Bible Bitch right away?
Yeah.
Mind if we just do Bible?
Not at all. Jump right in. I just...
Because we're going to lay down some scripture today for the Tea Party members who think that crashing the economy and shutting down the government...
Is a good idea.
Servitude to getting their way is a good idea.
And regarding the Pope, I know there are people who think that no matter what anybody, any leader or any member of any faith does about anything... it's awful because all faith is patriarchy and all patriarchy is oppressive or some such equivalent.
Or, you know, flying spaghetti monster. And, you know, atheists have a place in my heaven. They're all going to get into heaven before I do. So I'm not even going to get into it. I don't.
Yeah. I'm just saying that if you view things like this from the outside and it doesn't matter what goes on inside. Mm-hmm. Because it's all just a bunch of hooey anyway, then it's a trivial story. But it's not a trivial story if you're one of the billion Catholics around.
You know what else, though, Driftglass? It's not a trivial story if you are a recipient of social justice from an institution that can actually help to provide food, clothing, equal rights, start treating people with equal rights, advocating for the poor.
Yeah.
I think of... Bobby Kennedy and Stephen Colbert.
Yeah.
And a whole lot of other Catholics who take their responsibility to make this world a better place and advocate for the poor to be the primary reason they are here. And that matters.
And when the
head of the church
and when the boss at the back of the home office says, all right, lay off the gays.
Right.
Quit obsessing over
about
them.
Abortion.
And quit. And focus on helping the poor.
Helping the poor.
That actually has a tangible...
We can unite with that. That doesn't mean I'm going to become a Catholic.
Oh.
I'm not a Catholic. So, and it doesn't mean that a non-believer or an atheist or an agnostic has to change their belief structure in any way to appreciate, join with people that want to advocate for the poor. We can unite under that banner.
Well, and
that's my point.
I just want to say... the lad and I had a conversation yesterday or the day before about changes because he was very upset over China and I allowed his house. It was pretty terrible, but going from killing tens of millions of your own people to now is an improvement.
Mm-hmm.
It's still terrible. And I said, you know, Southern bigots don't burn crosses and lynch people anymore.
Right.
And so as angry as we might be with them and as ignorant as we might find them, you have to acknowledge things have gotten somewhat better.
And I said that to him in the car today about Iran as well, because he is very interested in finding out who the bad guys in the world are. That's yes. Comic book thinking.
And it's and bad guys are uniformly bad and always have been and always will be. It's always the same kind of evil. There's no differentiation. Because
there's no difference between the Joker in Batman 41 and Batman 73.
No.
There just isn't. The Joker's still bad.
You know? And that's fine for comic book land. Yeah, but in the real world, that kind of thinking is extremely counterproductive and childish.
It is.
But Bible Bitch, I believe.
Bible Bitch. Mm-hmm. Bible Bitch is going to read to the Tea Party from Psalm 52. Why do you brag of evil, big man? God's mercy carries the day. You scheme catastrophe. Your tongue cuts razor-sharp, artisan in lies. You love evil more than good. You call black white. You love malicious gossip, you foul mouth. Good people will watch and worship. They'll laugh in relief. Big man, bet on the wrong horse. Trusted in big money, made his living from catastrophe.
Uh-huh. Wow. Ripped from today's headlines.
Ripped from today's headlines. Yeah. Psalm 52. And that is from The Message, which is a modern translation, contemporary language by Eugene Peterson. I love to read it because of all the prostitutes in it, but all the redeemed prostitutes in
it.
So, you know, that's always good.
One of the things I was thinking about today that I'd like to sort of talk about as we touch on every other topic is why we can't talk to each other anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is, frankly, Newt Gingrich.
Who's been on TV this week giving advice about government shutdown.
Yes. And
as he's got, you know, he's marketing that.
As a reminder to our listeners, periodically it's helpful to remember that Newt Gingrich had a thing called GOPAC in 94, where he taught the freshman incoming House members how to talk to the cameras.
Well, and to his credit, I will give Newt Gingrich credit for lots of things, actually, because he was forward-looking in terms of dissemination of information.
He was.
He handed out cassette tapes.
He did.
Of his lessons to Congress, and they listened to it on their flights back and forth to their home district.
Yeah, how to talk like Newt.
How to talk like Newt, yeah. And so, and he has continued to embrace Twitter and have a Spanish Twitter feed for his campaign and all these other things. You know, he's not outside of the David Plouffe school of communications. He's wrong about everything.
He's evil, but he
gets that. There's ways to use technology to get, and he's been an early adopter of most of those kind of technologies. So that helps spread the evil that is Newt Gingrich. I'm not denying that.
And he taught an entire generation of Republican lawmakers exactly what conservative radio was teaching an entire generation of Republican voters. Exactly. So there was this absolute symmetry between what Republican lawmakers were saying inside Congress and later inside the state houses, and what Republican base voters, because that's the only people who matter anymore, Republican base voters were hearing every day on the Rush Limbaugh show. And it was, and Gingrich's instructions to his people were very clear. Every time you're in front of a microphone, every time you're in front of a camera, repeat after me. Here are a list of words to use. Always describe Democrat, not Democratic candidate, but Democrat, the Democrat Party as traitors, cowards, welfare,
wimpy,
yellow, bureaucrats. Just demonize all the time, every
day. So now that's what their party is defined as, is those who hate Democrats. And there's no idea behind it to gut from which to govern.
And the Democrats they hate, the liberals they hate, are largely imaginary, are creatures of their worst, darkest nightmares that have been placed there by Rush Limbaugh. Mm-hmm. And so they reverse engineer everyone who crosses their path into that template. So I look at Barack Obama, I see a Dwight Eisenhower Republican, an Eisenhower George H.W. Bush foreign policy, Eisenhower on social issues, you know, real center right conservative Rockefeller Republican.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They see a radical bomb throwing, snuggling Kenyan, up with
usurper.
Kenyan, palling around with terrorists, Muslim Brotherhood, wimp, tyrant. And they saw that the minute he came into office and have not varied from that view, because that's the only language their brainwashed little skulls have in it anymore. That's the only way they comprehend the world.
Which is why when you get close enough to a one of the people sitting in the defund Obamacare meetings and asked them, what exactly are you against in Obamacare? They can't tell you.
No, it's his. It's the black man in my White House's thing. With a D after
socialism. Yeah, it's socialism. Yeah.
It's evil.
And really, ACA is a consumer protection bill with a little bit of add-on for expanding Medicaid and making sure people who can't afford it buy health insurance who are not otherwise covered.
And
giving help to employers to cover their employees.
And a bunch of cost control experiments. Let's try these 30 things to see if any of them will bring costs down.
And already have. Yeah. And they already have.
So. But that's why we can't talk to each other. Because literally the language they use to describe people like you and me is so completely unrelated to who you and I are.
So in that vein, Driftglass, let's play Guess Which Party.
Guess Which Party.
All right, you want to start or do you want me
to
start?
Sure. Guess who spent $700,000 of his state's money to root out welfare fraud and found 45 possible cases of welfare fraud?
Possible. They need further investigation.
45 possible cases of welfare fraud.
In the entire state.
And it's Maine Governor LePage, a Republican. And again, this is reverse engineering your bigotry into public policy. We know that we're being bled dry by these welfare cheats, by these probably Negro welfare cheats and these Young Bucks
in
welfare
Maine?
Tweets. Yeah, well, you know, and they found all 45 black people.
45 black people in Maine and decided they have to investigate whether or not they're on welfare before they find out that they're fraudulent.
Yeah. And since that's the only problem our brains are conditioned to focus on anymore, we cannot think about anything but welfare cheats and moochers and liberals and Muslim Brotherhood president. We're going to reverse engineer some way to find, and because we want to cut government fraud and waste and abuse. We want to, but our mythology is that all of these social programs are basically giveaways to lazy poor people. Yeah. So by God, we're going to fucking find some lazy poor people, even if we have to invent them. Even if we have to spend nearly $1 million to find 45 of them.
$1 million to find them.
In Maine. So yeah. Hey, you want to take the next one?
Sure. Guess who says they are stuck making $172,000 as a congressperson?
Not me.
And this has gotten a lot of press.
Yeah, it has.
Representative Gingrey, MD of Georgia,
who complained
complained that his staff can go out, and go through that revolving door and make $500,000 as a lobbyist on K Street.
Yeah, but he's stuck.
But he's stuck making $172,000. And I wanted to point out that Li Fang on Twitter found the, to his credit, went and found the financial disclosure statement for Gingrey, found out that in addition to his $172,000 a year salary, he makes $90,000 a year in rents and dividends from all the Walmart stock and property companies. And, he's got lots and lots of money.
And as a member of Congress, what he is doing is covering his staff's retreat.
Yeah.
He's making sure that revolving door stays open. That's his job.
He was at a meeting of Republicans who were complaining about how they were going to be required to buy health insurance in the exchanges. Their employees were going to, might have to be required to buy health care through the federal exchanges. And, we want to be exempt from everything that has to do with ACA. So,
Hey, I got a question for you.
Yeah.
Guess who responded to Monday's shooting at the Washington Naval Yard by calling for more people to be armed and insisting that blaming guns was like saying obesity was caused by too many spoons?
Too many spoons of bullets?
Too many spoons of bullets. Hey, Louis Gohmert, guess what?
Oh, guess what party he's in?
There is no spoon, Louis Gohmert.
There is no spoon.
Did I blow your mind, Louis Gohmert? Again, Louis Gohmert is basically, Louis Gohmert exists so that people like me can make fun of him.
Yeah. I mean, in some respects, if one of the Republicans who's voted for Obama in the past two elections said to me, that's really not fair. Louis Gohmert isn't my kind of Republican.
Yeah.
I would say, you're right. But you know what? He is a Republican and you need to change parties.
Right. He is. You want your party.
He's a face and a voice within the Republican Party. you can't sit there and say, yeah, but part of my party is reasonable.
Yeah. And that part is being smothered.
Yeah.
In its crib by Louis Gohmert. And Louis Gohmert, let's face it, you know, Louis Gohmert is the geek of the party. And I don't mean that in the good new way. I mean that in the old circus freak, guy who wallows in his own filth, bites the heads off chickens. And everybody looks at him and goes, oh, my God, that is the grossest fucking thing I've ever seen.
But they keep the camera running.
Exactly.
Just like we do. Yeah.
He draws. He's a draw. He's an attraction. And everywhere Louis Gohmert goes, you know he's going to open his mouth and say something colossally stupid, because the people who voted for Louis Gohmert like him and want him to keep staying out there in the world saying the stupid, bigoted, crazy things he says, because he reflects those people. They're the problem. He's just the melanoma on the surface. They're the real problem.
Let's talk a minute. We had a victory this week.
We did.
Larry Summers.
Yeah.
Dropped out of the race for Fed chair, and I'm once again on my love-hate-love relationship with Chris Matthews. I'm back on the hate bandwagon because he did a segment about the anti-feminist, it was such an anti-feminist angle of, it's all because Larry Summers said that women weren't good at math.
Right.
And that therefore all these feminists got all huffy, you know, they need to take a pill, right?
Got their panties in a bunch is what
happened. Yeah. And he had Catherine Parker on, who said, yeah, you know, just because he said one thing one time, we're now calling for his head. And I consider that a type of fascism.
Yeah, you would.
And the thing is, I'm pretty much in the blog world all day long, the liberal blog world all day long.
Yeah.
And yes, people brought that up, but that wasn't the reason he was disqualified from being Fed chair among anyone I talked to. Anyone who emailed me about this, any of the activists that talked about how Summers shouldn't be there. It was about him being a paid consultant for Citigroup.
Yeah, and
that
being wrong.
Was the problem.
And being wrong. Being wrong on
everything. Yeah.
About derivatives and about a lot of things going back many, many, many years. And being
part of the problem instead, and bringing that problem back into power was what we didn't want to see happen. Yeah.
But that opens a whole bunch of...
You can't say that on Chris Matthews' show.
That opens a whole bunch of cans that nobody wants to... Because the people at Chris Matthews' pay grade... are friends of Larry Summers. He's one of them. He's a Harvard president and a rich, powerful man who hangs out with other rich, powerful men. And you can't say the reason we're not going to give you the job, Larry, even though we sort of kind of said we would and we sort of kind of promised, is because you're a douche and you were wrong. You're a very smart douche, but you're a douche and you were wrong, and you were really wrong about a lot of things. We can't really put that on your resume.
You're Wall Street, and we're not going to allow Wall Street to run the Fed this time.
So we're going to pretend that the real reason is a bunch of crazy liberals wave their arms and says, oh, he hates chicks.
Liberal chicks got their panties in a bunch.
Yeah. And so, except that's not what happened.
You got to kowtow to these feminists.
But this is – it is – you know, one thing we don't do very well is celebrate our victories here on the left.
Yeah.
And I think it's time to acknowledge that one of the reasons that Larry Summers got shoved aside when clearly he was the front runner and clearly the people, Barack Obama and his administration would have much rather had Larry Summers, was you had people who were actually expert in their field, could actually speak with some gravity and some seriousness about economics, who said he shouldn't be the chair. And you had Elizabeth Warren being elected. You had the one thing the Tea Party did that Occupy never got around to or couldn't be troubled to do was actually getting people elected, people with power, people that actually influence votes and create public policy and push the conversation along. Because the people who run media corporations and the people who run the government are those people. Everyone else is a spectator. And you can participate and you can be in the audience and you can wave your hands and you can blog like I do. But the people who really shove public policy left or right are a relatively small group of people. And the Tea Party at least focused on trying to get their people into that circle.
Right.
And Elizabeth Warren is now a United States senator.
And we should celebrate that. And we should celebrate that having a voice in all of this matters.
It really does. And there is a place for protest and there's a place for speeches and marches, and I won't diminish any of that, but eventually it has to lead to some kind of concrete action that involves persuading people to go to a polling place and put your guy or your woman in office.
Right.
And until that happens, you're just noise. So, speaking of just noise,
you want to talk about the newsroom? We watched the most gut-wrenching episode of Breaking Bad.
Yeah.
Thus far, and we've done a separate podcast about that. But right after that, we turned to the newsroom, and oh my goodness, it was happy story puppy time.
If I would, on my blog, I summed the entire season finale up in 6 seconds. The 6 seconds from Caddyshack.
Caddyshack.
Which is where,
Rodney Dangerfield.
This is where Rodney, I'm sorry, I was just cracking myself up. I shouldn't. Rodney Dangerfield says, hey, everybody, we're all going to get laid.
Yeah.
And that's it. It's everybody. You know, Tiny Tim shows up and he's cured and Old Man Potter is redeemed and everybody stands and sings hallelujah and every enemy is reconciled. Every tear is dried. Everybody who has a crush on everybody gets to go home with who they love. And, you know, the clanking of artificial plot devices stomping through the set to make sure all this works out in 1 hour was just deafening. It was really bad. And the thing,
and it really felt like they don't think they're going to have a third season.
Yeah,
they are. Exactly. And now they've got a, I really am waiting for the opening of the third season to be Will McAvoy in the shower and it's all a dream.
Yeah.
You know,
he was just high.
I was just high. Yeah. Hey, speaking of the newsroom, can we talk about Chuck Todd?
Yeah. Yeah. I just want to say it was, it was like watching David Gregory interview David Brooks about David Broder. It was so boring and so flaccid and so vacant and so just it was an exercise in almost sadism.
Yeah.
Of just, I'm going to kill you with saccharin. I'm going to smother you with happy, funny, you know, lovey bunny noises and leave nothing unresolved. All tension is gone. Every single thing that made any conflict in a show, which is what drama is all about, has now been dissipated and cast to the four winds. And I just thought that was really incredibly stupid.
It seemed like it was the end of the whole series.
It did. And the end of the series should... There was another way to do it other than killing everyone with saccharin. But apparently Aaron Sorkin saw things differently. And it's his show, not mine. So, yeah, let's talk about Chuckles, shall we?
God.
Oh, Chuck Todd.
And, you know, he's claiming on Twitter that he didn't mean what he said. But
yeah. And his Twitter is even worse. I mean, his response is... But you know, he gave the game away. You're not supposed to do that.
He did give the game away. He said, essentially, I don't have the quote in front of me. I'm sorry. But, oh, wait, I do. I have Talking Points memo in front of me. He said that it's the White House's job to sell Obamacare. Mm-hmm. And it's not the media's job to correct the lies that are being told.
Yeah.
Here's the quote. According to Todd, it's President Barack Obama's job to educate the public on Affordable Care Act. But more importantly, it would be stuff that Republicans have successfully messaged against it.
Yeah.
They don't repeat the other stuff because they haven't heard the Democratic message. What I always love is people say, well, it's your folks' fault in the media. No, it's the President of the United States' fault for not selling it.
Yeah. And at that moment, you heard this rumbling sound as everyone... from Mike Royko to Mark Twain to
spinning in their graves.
Spinning in their graves. Like, what the fuck did you just say? It's not a journalist's job to report the facts.
Right.
Really? And you're on
it's
the record.
It's only
now.
Your job to reflect who is doing the best sell job.
Yes.
And that's why we went to war in Iraq. That was my point was, of course, this lets you off the hook for the Iraq war, because Bush did such a good job selling the war, right?
And it wasn't your job to check to see if he was lying
right,
or not.
No.
It was just your job to stenographify what he said and then turn around and ask the other, you know, the red ant in the black ant, red ant controversy, what their opinion was, and just put it in a bottle and shake them up and stand back and collect your paycheck. That's really and truly, that is what Chuck Todd thinks journalism is. You never check facts. You never check whether 2 and 2 is 4 or it's 20 or the earth is round or flat. Whatever someone says is what they says and say. And you just, your job, and this really is that the David Brooks, David Gregory,
yeah.
School of Journalism.
Yeah, I'm going to write down what they tell me to write down.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, triumphant. It is, and proudly, and he's not making a secret out of it anymore, that we don't fact check.
Yeah.
David Gregory said that he doesn't do that. I mean, I remember distinctly him saying, that's my audience's job, basically.
Yep.
They can go check the facts to see if I'm... What? What
I'm here to have newsmakers on the air and let them talk, and then
you figure out if they're telling the truth.
You figure it out if they're telling the truth.
And I'll invite some other people on the show who might or might not push back, but based on their guest list, you never ever. David Gregory never has anyone on his show who will challenge David Gregory or David Gregory's view of the universe. And,
well, and we should talk about that too. Barney Frank last Sunday.
Yeah.
Got asking a question about if the banks are doing so horribly, why are they paying themselves so much money?
Yeah.
And the embarrassment and the change of subject happened so fast.
Yeah, it was. That, it was funny.
Yeah.
It really was funny. Just like,
and really what we need to do is be concerned about villainizing the bankers, because really the economy is what we need to improve.
Like, for God's sakes, people. Yeah. You know, we've got to protect our phony baloney jobs.
Blah, blah,
and,
blah, blah.
And again, seeing them get so lazy that they don't even bother to lie about how incompetent they are anymore. They just sort of throw up their hands and say, what the fuck do you want, man? You know, that shit requires work. I'm here to collect my paychecks, say my lines, and go home and meet up for 18 holes with David Gregory at the Chevy Chase Country Club. That's my fucking job. Mm-hmm. And you're getting in the way of me getting paid. And, you know, there used to be at least a couple of shows on in the morning that broke that mold a little bit, except they're not really there anymore.
But Steve Kornacki had a game show on.
Yeah. Dear Steve Kornacki, please stop talking about New York and New Jersey politics. I get it. I get that that's where you're from, and that's what you know, and that's great. But I'm really disturbed at what's happening at MSNBC.
Yeah.
Because that really was the last bastion. And it really was this, I think I said before, it was Rachel Maddow had a sort of a Greenpeace corner office at the headquarters of ExxonMobil.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so there's a little tiny corner of the media corporation that is NBC where some people were allowed to provisionally say some things that were dangerous and true.
Mm-hmm.
And every day it seems that that's just – there's less and less of that available on the air. And people there are more and more constrained by that which they are allowed and not allowed to say.
Can we have an agreement, too, that when – when there is a shooting and certain people in the media, I'm talking about Wolf Blitzer, and I know that's a really easy target, but that we will tweet and Facebook, I will not watch shooting coverage. I will turn off my television.
Yeah, there's nothing to see.
Because the reason they're doing it is for ratings, and let's teach them in our own way, take a stand. I'm not saying it's going to work, but at least take a mental stand against this 24-hour wall-to-wall guesswork, constant guessing and naming and blaming, and it's worthless coverage. It is utterly worthless. Just go to your social media and say, they're doing it again. There's nothing to see here. I'm turning it off.
Go pick up, go crack a book.
Go crack a book,
Go pick up Upton Sinclair. Go pick up Mark Twain.
Yeah.
Go pick up some classic literature, because unless... if it's an ongoing crime where there's a person or persons who are on the loose, or this might be one of several, and the public needs to be warned and vigilant, even then cable does a terrible job of doing that. But that's a legitimate reason to...
Well, if you're in the area, you might want to know when that person's apprehended. I get that. But I'm in the middle of a cornfield in Illinois, and this shooter was in D.C. I need to shut off my television.
Right. 4 hours.
Pray for those people.
Yeah. Yep.
And... not let Wolf Blitzer take over my mental capacity to deal with today.
Yeah. We've been watching the white Ford Bronco for far too long in this country.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's time to not watch it anymore.
Stop watching it. Yep. Mm-hmm.
And speaking of things that are not going to happen.
this is your segment of the show.
Yeah, baby. Let me. This is just fascinating to me. I just ding Steve Kornacki for being too local in his coverage.
And now you're going to talk about Illinois.
I'm going to talk about Chicago and Illinois. Well, I'll talk about Illinois for 4 minutes.
Yeah. Okay.
So go ahead and speed ahead 4 minutes. But it's Bill Daley. It's Richie Daley.
Explain who Bill Daley is, because he's never been mayor of Chicago.
No, but he's been everything
Daley
else.
Daley, who's never been mayor of Chicago.
But he's been everything else.
He's been ambassador to China or
something. No, he's been. He was White House chief of staff.
Oh, yeah. That's
and
right.
He was the guy who headed the Gore. He was the first guy to bail out of the Gore recount in Florida.
Okay.
Theory holds that being from the Daley family, he was the first to recognize that a state that's run by the Bushes, the Bush family, is not going to suddenly go for Al Gore. Mm-hmm. That all recounts will be controlled by family. But he's Richie Daley's former mayor of Chicago, smarter older brother. Mm-hmm. He's been in politics forever. He's a Daley. He's a son of the first Richard Daley.
He's also a banker. He never ran for public office, did he?
Well, see, here's the thing. He has been head of a telecommunications company. I think he was head of SBC for a while, back when the mayor of Chicago suddenly decided it would be a good time to have contracts signed with phone companies. His brother happened to run a phone company. Mm-hmm. And then he left that, and he ran, I think, J.P. Morgan for a while. But he's gone from one C-class job, flying all over the world, making shitloads of money, incredibly powerful, not elected by anybody, after another. And then last election cycle, he sort of toyed with the idea of running for governor. This election cycle, he started an exploratory committee, and he said he thought about it very clearly and carefully. And the thing is, if you're from the Daley clan, it's not like you don't know what's going on politically in your own state. This is his home state. Mm-hmm. This is a Daley running for a political office in Illinois, a second generation Daley. And his brother, mayor of Chicago for 22 years, only quit that job when it turned out that he had created an empire he could no longer pay for. Mm-hmm. His brother made political peace and created this long, his legacy out of buying off people and aligning with people and basically giving money away, which worked great as long as revenues were going up. The minute revenues started going down in the city of Chicago, he sold off the Skyway, which was a disaster, and burned through all that money. He sold off the parking meters, money that was supposed to last for decades, lasted about 3 years. And he scrambled to get the Olympics because he needed quick cash, because he had made a lot of political promises and built a lot of infrastructure and signed a lot of contracts based on revenue going up forever. And suddenly the economy was crashing and he couldn't pay for it. And the machine doesn't work in a recession. The machine doesn't work when there's no run. So,
and that's true of a lot of city and state governments. That's a problem in Michigan. That's a problem all over. Is as long a recession creates a huge dip in tax revenues. Yes. Period. Yeah.
And he saw it coming. I mean, people inside the budget office saw it coming several years in advance. There was, you know, significant revenue downturn in advance for lots of complicated internal reasons. But they saw it coming and they knew. So there was a wave of buyouts. And there was another wave of buyouts. And the people who had their contracts bought out with the city, a couple of them I know personally, were reached out to by people inside the Daley administration because they didn't want to take the buyout. And the administration said, take the deal. Things are about to get very bad. Mm-hmm. Take the friggin' deal. Then there were layoffs, lots of layoffs, thousands and thousands of teachers and administrators, people from a government that had never laid anybody off before, ever, really. There were furlough days. There were all these, you know, massive cost-cutting measures. Whole city departments have disappeared. This never happened in Chicago, ever. Mm-hmm. And the entire Daley empire was built on a completely different form of government, where you could just, if you didn't like someone, you put them over at city colleges, and they stayed there. It was basically buying people off. And the minute that stopped working, he quit. Mm-hmm. Walked out, said, no, you know, I'm going to run for office. Oh, no, I'm not. And all the people who were under him, who were city departments and department chairs, people who said that they're going to be there forever and ever, they started quitting, too, because he's a good time mayor. He's not a hard time mayor. Mm-hmm. So the idea that if you're a member of that clan from Bridgeport, you can't read political tea leaves, you don't know what's coming, that you don't know that Illinois is in an incredibly bad financial situation. Just like Chicago, it has way too much of a pension obligation. It has contracts it signed 10, 15, 20 years ago that there's no way the state can cover. This, it runs into the tens of billions of dollars. So the state of Illinois is as screwed as Chicago was and is. Mm-hmm. And the idea that you'd step into that job knowing that you're going to
have... What's the factor of class that you can get indicted for being governor of Illinois?
Yeah, it sort of goes with every other one. Pretty much that's how we do it here.
Yeah.
We currently, for a while there, we had two governors in federal prison at the same time.
Yep.
And which is the record.
Four of the past six governors have served time in prison, something like that.
Yeah,
there are four governors within my lifetime who have served time.
Who've done time in the house of many doors. And... And And the incoming governor is going to have to disappoint political allies, fire people, consolidate, cut, break contracts, do lots of things that are going to make people very, very angry.
Yeah, well, and the reason that Governor Quinn, who's the current governor, I mean, there's a lot of people that hate him because of the problems that the state has, and who just, if you're in office, you're blamed for it. But it's pretty clear to anyone who's really watching politics in Illinois that this isn't his fault.
Yeah.
No, this and he's, I don't know about you, but I like Governor Quinn.
Yeah.
He's a good guy. And he has done, he is the blessing of living in a blue state in that not only has he done nothing to stop the Medicaid expansion, which we're going to get into in a minute, he's embraced it, but he's had the Health and Human Services Secretary come to his office and talk about ways that Illinois can be a, you know, experimental ground for other cost-saving measures.
Yeah.
And, you know, we can use Illinois as a guinea pig to do this and this and this and try to save money here and still provide good services and work with hospitals and so on. And just really, you know, come on in, Kathleen Sebelius, let's work together.
Yeah.
And you definitely feel like his motivation is, if you're a resident of Illinois, you should have health insurance. So.
And there was about to be a bruising Democratic primary because it would be Bill Daley running against the incumbent. Yeah. And my only point after all of that, you know, all of that flapjaw is Bill Daley comes from the one of the most powerful political families in Illinois who've been in power for half a century on and off. And who have, you know, who have filled lots of political offices and who are friends of corporate bosses and have access to information that you and I will never see.
Right.
Travel around the world. And they're the elite. They're the 1%. And the idea that he would first get into a race, having announced, I've carefully thought about it. I've thought about all the contingencies, you know, with a name like Daley.
Yeah.
And then run for a couple of weeks and then say, you know, politics is really hard. I didn't realize how hard it was to run for office. I'm going to get out. It's so ludicrous. It's so fucking ludicrous. There's something else happened. I don't know what it is. Either he collected on a political debt or he created a political debt. I mean, he created an IOU. Pat Quinn, you owe me now.
Or it may be that, or it may be just that the moneyed interests in the city of Chicago told him.
Step aside.
This is not necessary for you to do this. Or
they've looked at the numbers and it's going to be a Republican governor.
Yeah.
And no matter what happens, you know, it's going to be such an ugly fight to win.
If we're going
to
attack the current sitting governor, then you know,
in which case
you're basically being a teabagger on the Democratic side.
Yeah, and you're going to lose anyway.
You're going to lose anyway because, well, for one thing, the Daley family name is gold in Chicago and shit in the rest of the
state. It really is.
You're not going to win a statewide office. So run for mayor there.
Run for something. Run for anything. Wait 4 years. Wait 3 years. But the cover story
isn't a young guy.
No, none of them are young guys.
Yeah.
But the cover story is so silly that it just begs kind of like, no, come on, really. What's the real story?
Yeah.
It's if you run as the Democrat who blew out the incumbent governor of your own party and then you lose, you're dead. You know, you can't run ever again. You've stunk up the place and you can pretty much forget about your political future. So Daley's never do anything unless the wind is at their back. And Daley's never do anything unless the outcome is highly favorable for the Daley name to go on. They're like the Lannisters.
Yeah.
You know, they're the Illinois Lannisters. They're all about family and family name.
Family
and it doesn't matter how sucky you are as a person. You will protect the family name and you will consolidate power and you will pass it along to your children. And that's
speaking of power that's going to be passed along. Let's talk about John Boehner for
yes, now. Yes.
And then we've only got about 10 minutes left in this podcast. So, because you got to go.
I got to go. And I can duck back and do a few more minutes later, but I get you. We're short on time.
We are short on time today. Do you think John Boehner is on his way out in terms of in his own mind? Do you think he's getting ready to retire? Because a lot of people have told me that this week. Obviously, he's getting ready to retire because the government shutdown thing is so far from what he wanted to see happen.
I would say that John Boehner got the job. Let me back up. I would love to meet John Boehner's father.
Yeah.
And his family. and find out what motivates people like this. You know, there's, because we talked about this a little bit over lunch the other day when we were talking about what we're going to talk about.
Yeah.
And that's, and the idea that in some families, there really is this drive, and it comes from your family or it comes from your peer group, that you have to, whatever field you're in, if you're not the number one in the field,
mm-hmm.
then you're a failure.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And the number one as a congressman is the Speaker of the House.
Mm-hmm.
And so you will, by God, become Speaker of the House, even if it's a disaster.
Yeah.
Even if you're so ill-suited to the job and your party is going to make you look like a eunuch and humiliate you and drag you around by your balls until you beg for mercy and you're a failure and you can't get anything done and history will laugh at you, John Boehner. Even if that's the case, I have to do it because daddy will be disappointed, you know?
So yeah, I know somebody who still talks about graduating fourth in their high school class.
Yeah.
Instead of first.
Oh,
and, I mean, in that frame of mind. No, I was not first. I was fourth.
Well, the
wait a minute. You were fourth in your high school class? That's pretty good.
Yeah.
No, I wasn't first.
All over the West Wing, there used to be, you know, Josh talking about his SAT scores.
Yeah.
Dude, you work in the White House. And it's a fiction, but everyone knows people like that who are just obsessed with, I have to have the next job.
Yeah.
And it's you know, that's Anthony Weiner, for God's sakes. I have to be the mayor because that will redeem, because then my mom will love me. And what the hell anybody would ever want to be the Speaker of the House with this Republican Party?
Yeah.
I have no idea. You know, unless you are a nihilist, unless you really are just crazy and you want to bring the government down and you haven't blinked since 1994.
Yeah.
And you're just kind of, if you're nuts,
well,
then
and
yeah.
The irony is that Paul Ryan doesn't want to be it. Doesn't want to be Speaker of the House.
Who would?
You know? No.
Who would? I mean,
he can be the ideological head of the Republican Party in the House of Representatives.
Yeah.
And not have all that administrative crap to deal with.
Yeah.
He used to be Speaker of the House, had actual power.
Who wants to go down as the smart one in the Manson family?
Really? Well, but you and I talked about this, that when you took earmarks out of the process.
Yeah. Yeah.
At the beginning of the Tea Party Congress, they decided that they would be virtuous and not have these awful earmarks anymore, which was how you kept party discipline.
Yes.
And you have money for your district. But that's wasteful government spending. So now
instead of holding a chairmanship over someone's head, if you try to do that, they'll just run against you.
They'll fundraise against you.
They'll fundraise against
money. Yeah.
Against you being in cahoots with the Kenyan usurper, because that's the magic.
I'm a maverick.
And
a maverick.
And when the only, you know, when the only coin of the realm is ideological purity, you end up like any other cult.
Yep.
Crazier and crazier and crazier until there's only 12 of you because everyone else is too impure to join your little party. But right now, that cult is just big enough and is locked in at the state level tight enough, thanks to a lot of money and advanced planning by people like the Koch brothers, that they can stay around and do lots and lots of damage, really, really wreck this place, which they've pretty much done already, for decades to come, at least for years to come. And prying them out of power is going to be just the work of a lifetime. Cleaning up the mess the GOP created over the last 30 years is the work of the next 30 years, tragically. But John Boehner is, you know, the guy who decided he'd run for captain of the Titanic after it struck the iceberg. So way to go, John. Congratulations. You will certainly go down in history as probably the worst speaker of the most incompetent House of Representatives in American history. So congratulations.
Can we talk about the one-sided recovery for just a moment?
Yeah.
And Robert Reich was on The Daily Show talking about hope and why he's a hopeful, optimistic person.
Uh-huh.
And one of the reasons he's optimistic is he says, look, we fixed this the last three times.
Yes, we did.
You know, the turn of the century, the progressive movement fixed this. The Roosevelt administration fixed this. The Johnson administration fixed this. And we're going there will be a reckoning when the American public decides that we're going to change things for the better. And part of me is depressed because never before has it been so generational.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
And that means it's going to take longer. But I agree with him. I'm hopeful that the next 30 years are going to bring a much more progressive zeitgeist to our politics. So
Well, it's ever been thus, right? It's always been the end of the world. The Republic is always going to hell in a handbasket. Children always hate their parents. Politicians are always corrupt. Everybody's maddened by fame.
Yeah.
And somehow we stumble through.
And I guess I want to caution my own brain a little bit about who I pay attention to. I mean, we're entertained by paying attention to Louis Gohmert.
Yeah.
But two things happened this week that kind of made me question where our attention is being placed. One was the Indian American Miss America, who is charming.
Yep.
And there was a reaction that there was a lot of racist comments on Twitter about her and that she's a terrorist. And one person in particular said something about, what do you expect? The president is an American.
Yeah. Well, you know.
And got a lot of attention. I went and looked at her Twitter feed and she got a lot of attention for that and wondered why people were tweeting her when I don't even know you, and not recognizing that this was a public forum that she's spouting this racist crap in.
Somebody dropped the microphone into a mental ward.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I looked her up and she appears to be about 14 or 15 years old.
Yeah.
And so I understand the need to kind of scoop up all this racism and expose it and expose it to sunlight.
Right.
But at the same time, the rantings of a 14-year-old, very ignorant child.
Yes.
On Twitter, bothers me. Just because she's a child, and let's just not to leave her alone, not to not let racism see sunlight so that it will be disinfected. And I mean that seriously.
Mm-hmm.
But let's not pay so much attention. I mean, this is something that some other podcasters have mentioned, of getting into a Twitter war with someone and finding out that person has 7 followers. And you're, why are you doing this?
Yeah.
You
know? Well, and this is you're coming perilously close to the drift class shrug.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, I occasionally run across or my dear wife mentions something that she's read someplace, because we try to keep ourselves informed. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, so-and-so Republican junior House member, House state senator, state congressman from, you know, sister beep, Arkansas, said something incredibly stupid today and talked about the president as a, you know, Sambo, blah, blah, blah. And well, of course he did, because now we have the ability to record the absolutely crazy, rambling, dregs shit mm-hmm. of people who never had access to a microphone before.
Mm-hmm.
And now not only do they have access to the microphone, but it gets bumped right to the top of the MSNBC news feed.
Yep, exactly.
And that's just really unhealthy.
And the other example was the TV preacher who I'd never heard of before this week, who talked about healing cheekbones. And there was a lot of mirth over her presentation, because sometimes TV preachers are really amusing.
Yes.
And there is that. But this video went up at a lot of liberal blogs, including Crooks and Liars, and of which I am a part. And I guess I feel, I mean, I'm not criticizing anyone for making fun of something that's funny, because I do that all the time.
Yes.
But I think in terms of politically going after someone, it's really important to figure out whether the statement they're making is a political message or not.
Yeah.
And if the person says, I can heal cheekbones with prayer, therefore we don't need that Obamacare, then that you need to go after that person. You need to go after them with a flamethrower.
Right.
If they're just sort of on their own little show musing about something, and again, it needs the sunlight to disinfect, especially with all the fundraising they do. I get that.
Yeah.
But sometimes I think these things are held up to ridicule, and they take up a portion of our brain that would be better served by talking with our friends and neighbors about the Affordable Care Act is helping us.
Yes.
So that's all. That's all. I'm not trying to lecture anybody, but it's important to figure out who we're arguing with and what we are arguing about. I guess that's my point.
I think I mentioned before, once upon a time, when I read the biography of Harry Houdini, how he got entree into the London press by bringing American press clippings.
Oh,
and the font that the broadsheets that the cheap journalism, the cheap newspapers use in America was so huge live today, Harry Houdini. You know, it was so gigantic that just the shouty cracker quality of the font impressed people that, wow, this guy must be something. Look how big the font was they used to describe him. And
yeah, you've made fun of the HuffPo 90-point font stories.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. Especially the ones, you know, about sexism and the sexiness of the sexism. But you have to go through all the side boobs and front boobs and diets and Arianna Huffington talking about how I have better sex through sleeping to get to the story about sexy sexism in 90-point font. But we're not trolling for traffic. By the way, it's not really a story. It's a slideshow. And every slide you click on counts for a hit.
Age.
So, yeah, I don't get my news from those people. I get my laughs from those people. But I don't get them from the poor person who gets sucked into it. I get it from the media empire that's built on making fun of stupid people who are not powerful. You know, silly, dumb people, let them be, man. I'm somebody's silly, dumb person.
Yeah.
Let them be. I don't have any power. I can't vote on anything. My vote counts as much as everybody else. I have a voice because my wife is a great sound editor and we've done 198 podcasts. But that's the only, and all of which we do from our house.
And I appreciate the fact that not only is this particular podcast Glenn Greenwald free, but also Iowa caucus coverage free.
Yes, next week.
Although I did disagree with Lawrence O'Donnell last night about Rand Paul being so brave.
Uh-huh.
Anytime Rand Paul brings up pot and drugs and voting,
yeah,
he is trolling for young Iowans to join his caucus.
Oh, sure, sure.
And
that doesn't mean he was wrong, though.
I think he was right. And yeah. I, you know, maybe he was brave and maybe his comments about Barack Obama will be used in a negative ad against him. I'm pretty sure they will.
Yeah.
But the point about making a speech saying the drug war is stupid and we shouldn't be arresting people for pot.
Right.
Is a campaign ad to the people of Iowa to get those young people to join him on the
sure.
phones.
I
where organization is king, and you need to do that in September of 2013. Sure. So
Rand Paul will never get my vote. And on this issue, and I'm not going to stand with him. I see right through him. He's a transparently ridiculous huckster who's selling an extremely dangerous ideology in that he occasionally dabs a little icing on that tastes yummy, yummy to liberals like me. And on this one thing, he happens to be right. On drones. I happen to, on the substance of it, agree with what he said before he completely reversed himself and everybody forgot that, oh yeah, he just lied.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There's some issues on which he occasionally is right, but I obey I think it was the Charlie Pierce 5-minute rule or 30-second rule.
Mm-hmm.
If you listen to him or his father for more than 5 minutes, eventually they'll say something stone fucking crazy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, it's not juice that happens to have a little poison in it. It's poison that happens to have a little juice in it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And if you don't get that, then, well, you're, you know, we've all fallen for that folly at one point or another.
Yes,
I'm sure I will fall for it again. And saying fall for folly is really hard to do this time of day. I need more coffee.
I'm going to read a little excerpt from a long letter we received from one of our listeners named Mary. I took to heart what you said a few weeks ago about Liberal Oasis co-hosts Bill and Tracy and the need to let people whose work you enjoy know how much you appreciate what they do. Their podcast, along with yours, is something that I would always look forward to at the end of the week. My sense is that Bill and Tracy were ready to move on, but I want you to know how happy I am that you guys are staying put. I appreciate the care and thought you put into your podcast, which is why I support you in this endeavor with a monthly contribution. Thank you, Mary.
Thank you, Mary.
We appreciate it.
And we really do.
Bill and Tracy were ready to move on, and we miss them, too.
Yeah, and we see Bill Scher showing up on
MSNBC on Friday. Yeah.
And we love seeing him.
Yeah. Each week, we post to our Facebook page and website an Internet Kitty sent in by you, the listeners. This week's Internet Kitty is Marmalade, another kitty who got swallowed by my email tsunami and has been waiting about a year. Marmalade is a crazy orange lady cat in the basement, but in happy times, she made friends with Fagin the ferret, and he is also in the picture, so you can see them together on our website and Facebook page.
The ferret stays in the picture.
Ferret stays in the picture in this particular instance, yes. You can send your Internet Kitty to us at our email address, proleftpodcast@gmail.com, where you can also write to both of us. We love hearing from you, so feel free to write us. Be aware that if you write us at any of our addresses, we reserve the right to read your email or U.S. Postal Service Go Postal Union's letter on the air, unless you say otherwise. Hey, Driftglass, how are the Internet Kitties doing this week?
Well, Blue Gal, the Internet Kitties were looking forward to being assistant Fed chair, but the man done took it.
Let's think about living. Just think about loving. Let's think about the hooping and the hopping and the bopping and the loving, lovey-dovey. Let's forget about the whining and the crying, the shooting and the dying, and the fellow with the switchblade knife. Let's think about living. Let's think about life.
The Professional Life Podcast is recorded under a Creative Commons license. Copyright 2013, Driftglass Blue Gal Podcast.
Minecraft is awesome. Now it's time for Science Fiction University with our science fiction expert, Driftglass.
I love Science Fiction University.
I know. Isn't it awesome?
Tell me more about this thing we're going to do where we talk about science fiction, which apparently now everybody talks about.
Yeah, what's the deal with that? Everybody's trolling you.
It's just...
And then everyone who listens to us sends us a link to the article that's right up alley, and then we troll them back. And I think there's a weird circle of attention going on there.
You know the story of, you know, two paths diverged in the wilderness?
Yes.
I'm convinced the opposite's going to happen to me, that there's a...
All roads lead to Driftglass, and then he's completely forgotten.
Once upon a time, I wrote about Tom Friedman, Sunday shows, Andrew Sullivan, David Brooks, and science fiction. And at some point, there's going to be a magazine that will hire Matt Taibbi and Charlie Pierce, who are great writers, but it's going to be an expose on, oh my God, did you realize that David Brooks was a complete douche who lies all the time? Who could have guessed it?
Who writes history?
Next week, a complete dissertation on Robert Heinlein and Philip Dick. And I'm just going to go, that's it. I'm going to do recipes from now on.
Well, you're going to be buried in a gigantic hole that used to be full of money.
That's right.
No one will remember you.
It's old copies of the Weekly Standard with David Brooks columns in them. Ew.
All right. We want to thank our dear friend at Magnolia ePublishing, who has sent you gifts in the past and is a good source for science fiction questions. He wrote us and said, heard you say you needed more questions. Happy to supply some.
All right.
11 questions. We're going to do these lightning round style.
Fire away.
Identify these stories from their first sentence. All are by Heinlein. And there are 11 of them. Are you ready?
No. And there's no scorekeeping. Remember, this is just for fun, people.
This is just for fun. No wagering and no scorekeeping. Okay. No. He actually provides the first line and the last line of each of these stories, but we're going to go with first lines.
Okay.
Number one, I know a place where there is no smog and no parking problem and no population explosion.
Oh, Glory Road. Easy.
Correct.
Come on, man. Throw me some.
Last line is, got any dragons you need killed?
Bring the heat, man. Bring the heat.
Number two, you see, I had this spacesuit.
Have spacesuit, will travel.
Correct.
Number three. What's the last line? Did he have the last line?
This is on the house. I threw it in his face.
Uh-huh. Okay.
All right. Number three, first line. The Proxima Centauri expedition, sponsored by the Jordan Foundation in 2119, was the first recorded attempt to reach the nearer stars of this galaxy. Whatever its unhappy fate, we can only conjecture.
Crap.
Last line is, from now on, Alan, always good eating.
Crappity crap, crap, crap. Let me tell you what it's not, just for fun. It's not a story called Universe, because the Jordan Foundation ship that is mentioned there, I'm pretty sure, is the same one that is a gigantic generation ship. It's huge. It's the size of a small moon. Mm-hmm. And there's a mutiny that happens on board, and the crew forgets that they're on a spaceship. And thinks the entire universe.
Does that predate this story, or does that go after this story?
It's the story. The thing that you're referencing is the story of that story. And that story, I think, was called Universe. But this is being referenced by some in some other story, and I don't know what that story is.
The story is Orphans of the Sky.
Oh, okay. All right.
Number four. Our troop had been up in the High Sierras that day, and we were late getting back.
Oh, man.
Last line, I smiled at her. I am where I belong, and I'm going to stay.
Heinlein wrote for Boy's Life, so I'm guessing it's a serial.
Sounds like that kind of story, yeah.
I'm guessing maybe, what is it? Was it Door in the Snow? No, it's Tunnel in the Sky.
Farmer in the Sky.
Oh, bite me. Heinlein, damn you, Robert Heinlein, for having titles that are so similar.
First line, the chairman rapped loudly for order.
Yeah, that's a famous one. That's Lifeline.
Yes. And the last line of that is, when Baird was through, he pushed the basket away from him, looked down and spoke. I'm afraid I've ruined this tabletop.
It's a really clever story. This guy discovers a very simple way of predicting the date and time everyone's going to die. Mm-hmm. And it ruins certain industries based on not knowing when everyone's going to die. And the people who represent those industries
would
like him to stop, please.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Number six, put down that wrench. Last lines. The room rumbled and shivered as 2.5 tons of molten massive metal, heavier than gold, coursed down channels, struck against baffles, split into a dozen streams, and plunged to rest in leaden receivers, to rest safe and harmless until it could be reassembled far out in space.
All right. Based on the opening line, I would have guessed the road's got a roll about the first transit strike in the future where the roads actually move. But that can't possibly be it because the last line is about a nuclear accident. I can't remember what it is.
Blow-ups happen.
Okay.
Number seven. I woke up in bed with a man and a cat.
Oh, man.
The man was a stranger. The cat was not.
Yeah, okay. That's every third Highland story he ever wrote.
Yeah, and the last line does not help at all. And we all lived happily ever after.
Yeah, the woman is a redhead, by the way. And she's also a nuclear scientist who's a biochemist who likes sex as well. And a gourmet cook. The guy's just lucky to have her, but he doesn't realize how lucky he is.
Until the end, yeah. To sail beyond the sunset.
Yeah, okay. I got it right. Yay.
Number eight. Just as they were leaving, the telephone called his name.
Okay.
Don't answer it, she pleaded. We'll miss the curtain.
The telephone calling his name is a good example of where science fiction writing changed from being impressed by technology to just mentioning it in passing as if it's just part of the story, which a massive improvement in the genre. I'm going to guess Door into Summer.
Space Jockey.
Yeah, or Space Jockey. It could also be Space Jockey. I'm just thinking maybe it could be one of those two. Yeah.
Number nine.
Uh-huh.
The first quarter rocket from Moonbase put him down at pied-à-terre.
Oh, from Moonbase. So something coming from the moon. What's the last line?
The blast that shattered the box caught him full in the chest. The letters on the metal marker read, to the memory of Mr. and Mrs. Joseph Green, who near this spot died for all their fellow men.
It's... Highland writes a lot of stories about giving last full measure to save. I'm guessing it's possibly the Green Hills of Earth.
Gulf.
Okay.
Number 10, Johnny Dahlquist blew smoke at the Geiger counter.
This is irritating.
The last line is, when enough time had passed long, long after the heaped flowers had withered, the lead casket was enclosed in marble just as you see it today.
It's another one of those... A ordinary soldier discovers a plot and saves the Earth from menaces.
Mm-hmm.
It's either the Green Hills of Earth or something about the watch.
The Long Watch. That's
the Long Watch.
Yeah,
I have one of those.
Number 11, last one.
Huh?
First line.
I'm not doing so great.
Well.
I'm having fun, though. That's the important thing.
The first line is, my name is Holly Jones, and I'm 15.
Oh, crap.
And the last line is... I suppose Hardesty and Hardesty has more rhythm than Jones and Hardesty. It really sounds better.
You know that
sounds like she's getting married or he's.
You know that redheaded woman who's the nuclear physicist?
This is the same person?
This is her at 15. always the insanely clever. By the way, we have two of those in our house now,
yeah,
so
we
be
do.
Careful.
They're not redheads, but.
No, but they're the same. They're
science geeks, yeah.
They're the same kind of incredibly clever.
Yep.
Funny, smart,
taking
stray animals.
Than you are, and you might as well just admit it. Yes.
Yeah. And can we have more cats? Can we take in more strays? Boys are icky and they're stupid, but
boys
are
stinky. But we have to put up with them because who's going to play Minecraft with us?
Some of them are nice.
Some of them will play Minecraft. That's right.
You know how I tap dance away from answering the question because I think it Podcane of Mars maybe.
It's the menace from Earth.
Oh, yeah.
All right. What we really need from Magnolia ePublishing is for him to send you 11 plots of Heinlein stories and then...
Yeah. And like a true great scholar of the Torah, I will put a pin in the story and tell you through a single letter and tell you on page 13 what letter that pin intersects. I'm not quite that good.
You're not that good.
This is all stuff I read 20 plus years ago, mm-hmm. more than that, probably.
The theme that I pick up on this, who I haven't read nearly as much Heinlein as you have, hardly any,
uh-huh.
but the boy's life theme, my goodness.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It was
Johnny Dahlquist. I mean, what kind of a name is that? That's definitely a 1950s boy's life name.
That was the market. I mean, there was, you know, you couldn't write adult fiction until Kay Tarrant decided to, until people figured out how to get past the editor at Astounding,
yeah.
who was a single person who stood in the way of having sort of adult themes. And so you had a lot of juvenilia. And it was really good, but it was really written with the sensibility of people who were in their teens, who were probably, you know, scouts.
Yeah.
It was good stuff, and it was well written, but it was written within those constraints. So no big surprise there.
Thank you, everybody. You can send your science fiction questions to Stump the Chump, as we obviously did today. To mrs.driftglass@gmail.com. And we do appreciate it. Have a great night.
Bye.